All right. So, who was at Hacking 101 last night?
Okay. Wow, I saw the demos.
So tonight is going to be a similar format. Some of it's going to be our traditional Q&A at some point. But for right now, we're going to do some demos like we did last night, some additional demos. And we're after the pizza break at midnight, we're going to do a trivia segment for you guys, asking you questions. And you can, of course, ask us questions as well. How does that sound? Yeah? Okay. All right. We are going to be collecting also for pizza and refreshments. Those of you who have been to Hacking 201 in the past know what I mean by refreshments. We got about $165 last night. So we definitely need more if we want to make it fun for everybody at midnight. So I'm going to have Emily right here bring around the collection plate. And it's like giving collection at church, just without the organs and with a little more cursing. So, yeah.
Salt is alcohol.
So, Emily, go ahead. No, yeah, the collection plate. It's a armor bucket. It's an armor bucket. Okay. So, first of all, I am going to allow our panelists to introduce themselves and tell a little bit about themselves. If you were at 201, some of this is going to be 101, some of this is going to be repetition. That's fine. We're going to start down this way and let them introduce themselves.
All right. Good evening, everyone. My name is Xavier Esch. I've been hacking since the late 80s, actually working in InfoSec since the early 90s. I tend to be more on the blue team side. I've been that's where my main focus has been, but I've done a little bit of everything. So hopefully I'll be able to answer most of your questions and have some fun tonight.
My name is Ray Kelly, and I've seen most of you all in the previous couple talks that I've done. So came from a company called Spy Dynamics. We were one of the first automated web application scanners, Web Inspect, and just been in security ever since. So it's been about 18 years I've been in this field.
My name is Jay Freeman, but everyone online knows me as Sork. I wrote Cydia, the alternative to the App Store for jailbroken iPhones, and maintained all of the runtime code modification tooling for that that ecosystem. A member of Exploiteers, previous member of Fail Overflow in the iPhone dev team. I did the Mempo Dipper and master key exploits for Android. So.
I'm Nick Whitehorn-Gillum. I'm a professional penetration tester, specialized in web applications. I was a web developer for a long time before that. Kind of got into it in the mid-90s. That was after some additional kind of coding stuff. Basically, I started when I was like 6. Yeah, that's pretty much me.
I'm Kevin. I've been Kevin for 46 years, Kevin Johnson for 18 less than that. I'm a nerd, been a nerd since 91, done everything from sysadmin to development. Some of my code still runs in the power grid, which should scare the crap out of everybody in this room. It scares me. Got involved in security a long time ago by accident and just kept doing it. Started a small company, hired him, hired some other people. You know. And I am the creator of Samurai WTF, which is a training environment for web application testing. Also wrote the SANS curriculum for web application penetration test and mobile security. Done a lot of stupid crap.
Okay.
Yeah, I like stupid crap.
And okay. I am Dustin Smith. You guys, if you've been coming to 201 for a while, you've seen me before. I've helped Drew out for quite a few years with it. And I ran an IT company here in Atlanta for approximately 10 years, on the dot, actually. And at this point, I'm doing government work up in Maryland. So that's a little background on myself. I work with one-way links, stuff like that. All right, so as far as the panelists go... standard question we ask every year. What does hacking mean to you guys? Go ahead.
Good stuff. So hacking, you know, in general, it's really you know, it's really learning how things work, right? It's not just it's the taking apart the toy and putting it back together to really understand how it works. When things got started for me, it was really amazing that once you learned how things worked, it was so simple, and then you say, wait a minute, you didn't think about X, right? It's just like if I hide the user manual, then you don't have to really. It's what we call security by obfuscation, right? Is we would publish, user manuals on how things work, and that's really how I got into hacking. Is really just learning how to get into things and just really understanding how things shouldn't work and going from there. So.
I'm in the similar boat. When someone says, "What does hacking mean to me?" I think of breaking shit. And literally, if you saw my demos today, it's about how do I use an application the way it's not intended. And by the way, along with forget the manual, one of the best pen test tools is use the manual to find a default username and password for a Linksys router or something like that. So always remember, the manual is also a great resource for hacking.
I'm definitely with Ray on that one, the idea of making things do things that they weren't designed to do. But I will say that sometimes it's something that was actively designed not to do, but sometimes it's merely something that is surprising, something that the person who constructed it had never thought that it could do, and then you're kind of pushing it past the point of using it in a sane way, in some sense. And we actually see this in real life hacks, where it's like, how did you get a car in that location? Cars aren't supposed to be able to get there. That's surprising. That is not what the car was, what anyone thought the car would be able to do, but you somehow got it there. What happened?
So I guess the parallel, and this really falls into the same theme, but the parallel that I like to kind of draw is if you think about a physical lock, right? It's a mechanical device, and it has a certain tolerance to it. If it didn't have that tolerance, if it had to be absolutely precise every time, then as soon as you had any wear and tear on your key or on your lock, they wouldn't work together anymore, right? So there has to be a built-in tolerance there. For me, hacking is finding that tolerance in any system that lets you manipulate things, and again, that can make them do things they weren't necessarily intended to do.
Because I don't feel like saying the exact same thing everybody else did, even though they are right. To me, hacking is learning. It's very simple, right? We don't know. We are all ignorant, right? Something we all need to remember is 50% of the people in the world are average or below in intelligence, and this room meets that. Not an insult, we have to learn. I'm an idiot. Every single day I try to figure one more thing out that I didn't know that day before, and that to me is hacking.
Very good. All right, so who wants to see some demonstrations? Yeah? I'd like to hear a little louder if you really want to see them. Come on. That's better. Okay. All right. You want to go ahead and do a demo?
Go, me.
I guess I'll turn this.
Whoever. Who wants to do one?
Oh.
They need a little bit of preparation time.
If we can cut the lights off too, that would be helpful.
Yeah, lights will be good. Let's hit the lights.
So while we're prepping, how many people here have been hacked?
Everybody raise your hand, all
right? Pretty much, right?
Yeah. Equifax, Target.
Social engineering, Visa, MasterCard, Discover. What is your highest credit card balance? Oh, okay. What's your credit card number and what is your expiration date? Has anybody ever actually given that to them? Some guy from India? No? Good.
Have you heard the
new... Where do you want to start?
I try to piss them off.
What?
There's a new one going around. With saying that your social security number has been compromised, please call them.
I'll be honest with you. I got a call probably around 10 months ago from the Social Security Administration, and they were telling me, what was it, that your social security number has been involved in some sort of fraudulent activity.
Yeah. Yep.
And we found 10 pounds of cocaine in a hotel room. Woo-hoo. Down in Houston, Texas.
Wow.
And I just wanted to fuck with them a little bit, you know? So I started asking them, well, what happened to the cocaine? What'd you do with it?
Dude, that's my shit.
And they didn't take that as a gesture that I was going to be uncooperative. We kept going on. And eventually they were asking for my social security number. They were asking for everything. And I just gave them all false information, wasted about an hour and a half of their time.
Mm-hmm. Wow.
Nice.
Yes. Do not believe anything you hear on the phone when people call you.
All right, go ahead.
All right. So everyone ready for sort of the first demo?
Yeah.
It's just a little kind of combination of web attacks. So This is a weak target that I made. I'm running it locally. Doesn't look like it, but I am. It's kind of a cryptocurrency exchange. So I threw that together. And then I have this other thing over here, different website. One website, the other website. This one has a little
free beer.
Kind of poorly styled button here for free beer. So, I hit that button, and I refresh over here, and we're missing some Bitcoin now. You want to see that one more time? Yeah, we're down a little bit more. Okay, so what's going on here? What actually happened? So it's a combination of two attacks together. One of them is called cross-site request forgery. Anybody here heard of that?
CSRF.
Yeah, CSRF, CSRF. Some people call it XSRF. I don't like that because it's not as pronounceable. So that's one part of it. And the other part of it is clickjacking. It's a UI redress attack. So if I go back over here, refresh my little page here, pop open my web developer tools, and take this button here. I've got my button. My button that I actually selected when I used the inspector there is the one that is stacked inside an iframe that is hidden behind the free beer button. So if I pop open to the source, there we go. Let's see if we can make it big enough. That's actually not the right project. There it is. And there we go. And I should be able to zoom in on that in a second. We have Zoom tonight.
Zoom,
you're
going to
make
zoom,
a Mac
zoom.
Joke, aren't you?
I'm not going to make a Mac joke. I don't need to. So what I have here, I've got this. I've got my hidden form. I've got my JavaScript here. Any JavaScript people in the room that can read that? A few people understand it. Loading the frame on the load of the page, yeah. So I have this pre-filled, right? I've got my transfer to email, I've got my currency, my value, pre-filled in hidden fields. And so the page loads, I've got a tiny delay, and then I let it submit. What that takes it to is the confirmation screen, and I'll walk through what that looks like in the actual app. And then that confirmation button gets stacked in behind the free beer button. So if I pull back out here, what I actually would be doing if I were using the application functionality would be something, and I should warn, there are very little kind of tolerances or checks at all on this app. There's pretty much anything you can do in it that goes off the beaten path will break it. It is floating around there in open source land, though. So, and it pulls up this confirmation screen. This is the same confirmation screen that you have inside the attack page that loads in the iframe. So, yeah. That's pretty much that it. Attack. Anybody have any questions about that one? Second attack was clickjacking. Yeah.
So the CSRF submits the form and then clickjacking gets confirmed.
That's right. Yeah. CSRF submits the form through the iframe, loads the next screen, and then scrolls it and shrinks it and positions it so that the confirmation button is hidden behind the free beer button.
Can we start off with the orange box?
There we go.
We have the box.
When the button is clicked, does it actually click both buttons or just the one underneath it?
I didn't wire up any functionality for the top one. I would actually have to check that.
Okay.
question over.
So, how do we protect against this?
Aha! That's the right question. I hear the answer out here. So for cross-site request forgery, for CSERF, there are a few options. The most common one that's built into a lot of frameworks is CSERF tokens. So the server serves up a token to the front end when it serves the page, usually. And then every request to the server needs to include that token in order to be considered valid. The attacker, in this case, wouldn't know a valid token, hopefully. It needs to be tied to the user session, by the way. They wouldn't know the valid tokens. They wouldn't be able to supply it. That's one. Another one is you can check the origin and referrer headers on the request. There's the double cookie submit strategy, which is you set a cookie that has a value, and every request needs to include that value. Because your site can read that cookie, you can include it. But the other site, being cross-site, can't. And one last option, you've got the same site flag on cookies, which is relatively young. But browser support's gotten there pretty quick for it, which will tell the browser not to send the cookie on a cross-site request.
So it's the website creator that has to protect against it? The user can't really do anything?
Not the user, no. It's up to the application to secure it against that. For the framing part of it, for the clickjacking, that's because it's frameable. So there are two main ways to deal with that as well. You've got the X frame options header. You can use it to say that your site can only be framed. I don't remember what the actual value is for same origin. It might be same origin. But you can also say no framing. The other thing is you can use a content security policy for it, which can do the same thing essentially.
Okay, so this is going to sound really trivial, but if you'll go back to that transfer currency page. The other one, you know, the one...
The transfer page?
Yeah.
Back here?
You know what, never mind. So, in that menu we're saying, all right, so I've got some money, I click the button, then you go back to that page, and the number went down drastically. Yeah, that one. Now, there are actually two types of currency, like TCE or B something or other. What do those acronyms stand for?
The currencies. So Bitcoin and Litecoin are the cryptocurrencies.
Or what's the difference?
They're spelled differently.
Okay, I'm just gonna.
One's worth less than the other.
One's fake money and the other one's fake money.
Faker.
Do we have any other questions? Where can we throw the box? Who wants a box?
Right here. All right. Here's the box. Who wants it?
Everybody good? All right. Did anybody else have a demo they wanted to do?
What?
Is there more demos on
there? I don't have one.
All right. I can.
All right. You want me to buy you some time?
Actually, the HDMI cable.
Is that all you want? Yeah.
Perhaps there's a general question for the panel while we set up.
How do you hack Hotmail?
Here. Didn't Hotmail already do that?
Yeah.
Shame on you for using Hotmail.
Hotmail. Yes.
Deserve to be hacked.
So the question was, is Russia trying to hack our power grid? And my answer is maybe. And the reason I say maybe is because, yes, they absolutely want to get in there. But it's not just Russia. It's also China, Germany, France, Palm Beach County, that dude. The other thing you got to keep in mind, though, is that it's actually in their best interest for our power grid to stay running. Because the information they want is only accessible if the systems holding it are powered up. So while they want to get into our power grid, the idea of this apocalypse, screw the world, we're shutting the power off. I mean, Dorian's going to do that. I don't see that as a viable option unless we push somebody into a corner, right?
I think our bigger worry is what they're going to do with the power grid once they have access, especially since for the last decade, we've been switching to a smart grid system. So, yeah.
Can you talk about how quantum computing is going to affect the tools that you guys use to defend and protect against?
What was the question? Quantum computing.
Yeah, how does quantum computing affect the tools that we use to protect systems? So there are a few encryption algorithms that we utilize which are easily defeated by quantum computers, to the extent to which if quantum computers were to actually become scalable and cost-effective. But we also have algorithms already for both doing symmetric encryption, hashing, and I believe also asymmetric encryption that are what we call post-quantum safe. They are oftentimes much more expensive for like using today if you do not feel like you are going to have an adversary who has a quantum computer. But we largely do have the techniques in order to protect against them.
Can I... I want to say that his answer is absolutely awesome, excellent. I do want to ask something about the question, though. We get people to click links and give us access to their entire system. Why are you worried about quantum computers yet? And I'm not saying that, I'm not being sarcastic. I believe there's a reason you asked that. What is your worry there? And I don't know who asked it. Okay.
We need a mic.
Hold on, we need to get you a mic. We can't hear you.
Gotta close the door.
Keep the door closed.
Hold the door. No, don't hold the door.
No, I'm sorry.
So I had read a couple articles stating that the advent of quantum computers and their prevalence in the society was going to really defeat the way that software and security is implemented. And so I was just curious to what your perspective was. Was that something that was real, or was this just something that they wrote for an article to get me to read it?
I will tell you that from my perspective, and I've been I've worked with hundreds, if not thousands, of journalists. My perspective is that you need to stop reading articles from whoever wrote that article, because what they're doing. And I'm not honestly, I'm not talking about you. I'm talking about the person, the jackhole who wrote the article. They just wanted to get attention. We have enough security problems that we don't, and enough security debt that we're all trying to pay down. We don't need to borrow from the future, right? Yeah. All seriousness, my opinion. And I got to use the word jackal.
Got a question over here?
Up in front.
Box.
Mike.
Box.
All right, so get creative with me for a second. What is the most dramatic or catastrophic, plausible exploit that you guys can think of for just the systems that come bundled nowadays in your standard issue car, new car?
I say we just run down. How about we run down the panel? Start at the end.
Okay. So you look like you have one prepared.
I know a guy named Charlie Miller, who's one of the people who worked on some of the early iPhone hacks, as well as he's done a lot of work on Android. He spent about a year and a half working on car hacks, and he had a hack for the Jeep Grand Cherokee, I believe, which allowed him to remotely cut the brakes of the car. And it's something that is like, the more we take all the technology that is on these, whether it be your refrigerator at home or whether it be your car on the road, and we network it all together and then attach all of that to the internet and we make it all fully software programmable, the more risk we run into of situations like this. And you can imagine a situation where instead of just working with a reporter in order to try to, in a relatively safe scenario, mess with his brakes, just say, all right, now all of the Jeep Grand Cherokees on the road right now. And it's just really terrifying.
What do you say about that?
Next question.
Software sucks. Like, it really sucks. And I think a lot of people understand this.
Yeah.
Software planners suck.
Well, except that you gotta... I mean, we can pick on developers, right? I mean,
it's hard, man.
But here's the problem with development. How many people here have written code professionally? And I don't mean screw around with something on the side. I mean professionally, right? How many of you have ever been asked by your boss, how long will it take you to do this? And then after you gave your boss a reasonable number, they subtracted a whole bunch and told you it had already been sold, right?
Sounds like almost every Dilbert cartoon I've seen.
Yeah.
And not only that, but security had no part in that timeline.
Absolutely.
No
Absolutely.
Part of it.
Right.
That's why you use the word risk.
They never use the, oh, and how much more will it cost to make that really secure?
Right.
Unless it's a bank.
How much
bank.
Risk are you willing to take on maybe. Deploying this thing?
Nah. Risk is acceptance.
I think it's more matters.
Since we just did the how many developers question, how many developers here have had security training specifically?
Define training.
Yeah. Was it?
We trained ourselves.
No, that's not training.
Yeah.
But does your company... Yes.
Company-sponsored training?
Yeah.
Okay. Was it good?
Very good.
Good.
I think it's getting better, what I've seen with the customers that we work with, as opposed to like 5 or 10 years ago. I think it's much better now. And companies, you know, their total incentive is to not be in the press that they got hacked, right? So I think companies are getting more serious about it. And I've seen an improvement over
I think you're working with better customers.
Well,
I mean, because I'll tell you, the experience I've had, I've got some really smart customers. I know they're smart because they hired us. But what we're seeing is that more and more companies are outsourcing either the development or procuring applications themselves. And what they're doing is they're writing into contracts that the contractor will handle security. And I'll give you an example. This is not a development example, but this is a real example that Secure Ideas did. We were hired by a company to come in and assess some stuff. Let's be vague, right? We were going to do some assessments. They said to us, can you answer this questionnaire about your computers that you're going to bring in? Because we're going to plug our machines into their network. And one of the questions they asked was, do you have endpoint protection? And we said, we don't. Not on the machines that we do our assessments from. While we can get around endpoint protection, it doesn't make sense to charge my customer for me to figure out how to get past my own endpoint protection, right? So we don't run it on those machines. And they said, oh, that's bad. We can't let you come in and plug into our network. And we're like, so we go back and forth with them, back and forth with them. The solution their procurement department came up with was, take a VM running Windows, install endpoint protection on that VM. When you're on site and plugged in, please start that VM and press pause.
What?
And it gets worse. For the 3 weeks we were there, at least once a day, they would walk into the room and say, Mike, show me the paused VM, and you would have to stop what you were doing, throw a paused VM to the front of the screen, and then go, cool, good, thank you, and walk out. So while, yes, I do believe things are getting better, I believe that we are so far underwater that we still can't see sunlight.
Right,
in
don't get
cases.
Me wrong. We're coming from nothing, right?
Yeah.
To a company buying a static code analyzer, right? At least one to start scanning source code. And it's just baby steps, right? But at least it's sort of headed the right direction is what I'm seeing anyways.
One of my concerns with respect to it, things getting better, is that I think that as we've been getting tooling that helps people make software they feel secure, as we get programming languages that make people able to make systems that are more secure, we find ourselves willing to increase the attack surface on them.
Yes.
We find this form of risk compensation where it's like, okay, you're wearing a helmet, which means that you're driving faster or your motorcycle faster. And so now we've ended up in situations where, yes, maybe it is you're less likely to find a bug, but when you find it, you manage to cut the brakes on all of the Jeep Grand Cherokees running on the road all over the world, as opposed to, okay, I managed to mess with one car that I had to have local access to or something.
I had a question getting back to, I was one of the developers that raised my hand that I'm a developer, but never had actual security training. I've taken security classes in college and hacking classes in college, but obviously real world. And I've even worked for a defense contractor for many years and was never taught actual legitimate security stuff. So my question is me and my company that I work for, how do we find the right people to come in and train us on security stuff?
Can you not ask the two guys on the panel who actually offers secure coding training?
What company is it you work for?
Into a sales pitch. That's what we do. It's one of the main things we do. All seriousness, I believe that we're awesome at it. I will throw out there, if you guys don't mind, if you're a veteran, first responder, active duty military, most of our training is free or highly discounted. And there are amazing things coming out of Jack Menino has some great training. My understanding is the Fortify guys have some great training. I haven't taken it. The biggest thing that you need to do is understand what you're doing. And in my opinion, the best training, and don't get me wrong, I said this a couple days ago when I was on stage, I'm a greedy capitalist. My goal is to be protested by the Occupy movement because I'm so wealthy, right? I'm not there yet, but I'm working on it. But the best training you could do is to sit with your team, sit with the other developers, and go through exercises and work through some of the things, like the example Mick just gave here. If you guys, when you get back to the office on Wednesday or Thursday, since it'll be a bit, right, sit down with everybody and go through something like that. Pull down Samurai WTF and pull through it. There's an entire six-day class that was open-sourced and released for free just on web security. We're not allowed to say that it's SANS 542, but it looks very familiar.
Right. Yeah, and not pitching any product, but so I'm on the Fortify team, and so we do have CBTs for training. Also, we partner with like Secure Code Warrior, which is a great tool also, and they actually gamify security testing. So it'll be like a test, a game sort of style to get trained on that as well. So we work with those guys also.
Okay, I'll get with you guys offline then. And we'll touch base, because my boss did say, find someone to come in and teach us how to be secure.
I've also had a lot of experience in just trying to get, overall funding and priority in the security budget for, secure coding, right?
Yeah.
A lot of times security teams love to buy boxes, right? These boxes buy, like I said, Blue Team, we just put stuff on top of and fix their code, right? WAFs and firewalls and all sorts of other things. But actually implementing security, secure coding as a program, and being able to understand and get to the right people that there is a business case to be made, that bugs found at different stages have actual costs associated with them, and especially when you're dealing with outsourced teams, is that if you can basically shift to the left, right, is when you get the PowerPoint there is like developer here. Static code, analysis, dynamic code analysis, production QA, QA and then production. Right? If I find it all the way over here, that's a very costly bug, right? If the pen tester finds it on a live system, that's very costly. It's like the cheapest way to fix it is over here when we first write it, right? So you want to move everything in that conversation, and you can build a security program out of it and get some really good funding to get the right training, the right technology, and the right priorities in place to help out the overall problems.
I had another question. So you're talking about, I've totally hacked into this guy's car and cut the brakes and made it play La Cucaracha for 7 hours straight. But I was thinking, isn't there logs for that? I mean, like, if there are logs, like, where is it logged and can you read the logs?
Yes, there are logs. One of the things about hacking is that most of the really scary stuff that we have, you don't realize it happened, obviously, if you're doing something as tragic as, you know, bringing somebody's brakes out, you know, they're going to know something's wrong. And then, yes, then when you can go look at the logs, and we kind of call that incident response, right? You, something bad happened. We now know it's happened, and let's go figure out how it happened. And there'll be lots of artifacts and ways of figuring that out. The scary part is when we don't know it's happened, right? We talk about the Russians going to, you know, do they care about our power grid? It's like they don't want to shut down our power grid, right? They would do other things that's not going to be obvious. So, you know, if I, yes, there's lots of logs, but if I don't know anything's wrong, I don't know to go look at those logs. And that's part of the challenge and with a lot of these is that it's you don't know that you've been hacked.
A funny example of that is like, look at Stuxnet, right? So we attacked Iran. We didn't shut down the centrifuges. We just screwed with them just a little bit to make them, you know, make their samples bad. And I thought that was, man, that's awesome.
There's also this problem with logs themselves where you have to be really careful with how you keep logs. So a lot of times logs are stored on the same system that the attack is on. And so once you manage to gain control of the system, you just delete the log. You also might have to log normal, mundane, boring events, things that you might feel like it's a waste to continually log because the attack looks like something normal from the perspective of when it arrived, but it was that it then messed with the state machine, corrupted the system. It did something wrong once it got inside, and so you essentially would have to moral equivalent of logging every letter that appears at your house and have a record of all of them in order to determine if at some point later there was one with a secret code in it.
And that's not cheap, right? And so I work for a fairly, I didn't say this during my when we started off here. I work for a bank, kind of a couple doors down here, and you know, we've got 1,300 locations, about to merge with another bank. They've got about 1,500 locations, you know, and so my logging system, we're doing several terabytes of logs per day, right? And that is not cheap. And even if I use open source and I don't pay, you know, Splunk a whole lot of money, right? Which we do. But I mean, you know, it's still, you know, that's a very expensive problem to solve. And it's just not trivial.
Yes, a lot of times Splunk will be used to parse through logs, but the licensing cost is insane. There are open source alternatives, but they're not even close to as easy to implement as what Splunk is.
It's a build versus buy. There's lots, I mean, just about every category of technology out there, especially in the security world, there's really good open source alternatives, but you're going to need a staff to support it, mm-hmm. and so it's a different cost model. And it really comes down to the company that you're working with and what their culture is and where they want to put their money.
Yeah.
Hey, at home, for the most part, I'm using Linux. So the two distributions I'm using is Linux Fedora and Linux Mint. Each one of them comes with their own software distribution. I was wondering, how well do they actually vet all that open source software that's on their default distribution? I was waiting
I'm
for
sorry.
That.
So, I think it was just either today or yesterday was the anniversary of the shell shock. Shell shock was introduced into Bash 9,000 days ago. Over 9,000, it was a valid vulnerability for 25 years. So it's there.
So 25 years ago, so is that Brian Fox, who wrote Bash, is a friend of mine, and he really laughed that there was, so in an interview Thursday, Mr. Fox, the Bash inventor, joked that his first reaction to shell shock discovery was, aha, my plan worked. Because people were essentially like, what were you thinking 25 years ago when you typed this bug in? And it's like, even before the internet existed, before the advent of all the software that interfaced with this, it would actually cause a problem. But yeah, it's intense how long some of these bugs last around.
The other problem with vetting open source software like that is that it's turtles all the way down, right? I mean, you look at one package, that calls another package, that calls another package, that calls another package. I mean, we can pick examples out of the air, the sheer number of times that something has happened. Left justify with NPM, right? I mean, yeah, well, but I'm not even picking on NPM here, right?
Let's pick on NPM.
There's there's a package after package after package. You can only go so deep before you have to just say, okay, I accept a foundation of unknown.
Yeah. We're all running vulnerable software, yep. Right? So that's the state we're in, is we have vulnerable software. And then how do you build your systems to be able to survive a scenario in which you've got vulnerable software, right? That's where you've got to, do your risk model, your threat modeling, and understand you are running on vulnerable software.
But the big thing there, if I may, is I find that most people don't understand what they should actually be worried about, right? Like I talk to people all the time, like, hey, how many people here believe that the biggest worry for their company is reputational risk, right? Somebody even said it up here, like, companies don't want to be in the paper. And not to be rude, but I say bullshit. Reputational risk doesn't exist, okay? Target is still in business. Equifax got called in front of politicians. They're still in business. Heck, the approval rating for Congress as a whole is somewhere around 18%, yet something like 90% of Congress people are reelected time and time and time again. There is no such thing as reputational risk. And I actually said that in a class once, and I had a guy argue with me, and he's like, no, my company has really thought about this, and our biggest worry is reputational risk. And I said, you knew it was coming. And I said, no, you're wrong. I don't normally say that, right? But no, you're wrong. Your company's biggest risk isn't reputational harm. And he says, no. I said, okay, fine. I'll bite. Who do you work for? And the guy said, I work for Comcast. See? And that is exactly the reaction I told you he was going to get. I told the guy that as a customer of Comcast, I would prefer them to be hacked because their network would run better. But the reality here is... Yeah. The reality here, though, is that most people don't truly understand what their concerns are. What are you worried about? And that's why I asked the gentleman in the back, not to pick on him, but he asked a question. It was a great question. But, okay, why? Why are you worried about that? I want all of you to think about this, right? What do you want to know? What are you worried about? What is the thing? Because I'll tell you right now, I'm not worried about my Social Security number. It's been compromised so many times, it's not even funny. I'm not worried about most of the things. So what's your worry? Right? And then start digging into that. When you talk about training people for developers, think about your company and think about what you should be most, what apps are you most concerned about? What attacks? Once you understand that underlying attack, then you can figure out the controls around it. That's the best way to go, in my opinion. So a little bit of a rant, sorry, yeah. But you know.
All right, question in the back.
Hi. So, in recent memory, there are Intel exploits with their hardware.
I'm sorry.
The well-known memory exploits, but louder. And recently, I was reading articles about more and more companies, fabless companies, coming out with neural net accelerators, hardware accelerators. It seems they're popping up every other day. Do you think the advent of more hardware production will be a new threat vector that you will see in your environments, or do you think that's not the most pressing issue?
Are you saying that the idea is that as more hardware gets constructed on this like smaller build quantities, that there's going to be more bugs that we get because we don't have as centralized or wide distribution? I'm trying to understand the question.
Yeah, in that direction.
It depends on if China's making it.
I think you already run into that problem a lot with the fact that we've got all of these little Internet of Things devices. I mean, the same kind of the build scale problem ends up occurring with the software as well. And the question is with hardware, it might be less easily upgradable. But how connected was it in the first place?
you about that.
I don't think it's a pressing issue at all.
Okay.
I think we have tons of piece of crap hardware being released every single day. Small runs of hardware. I mean, walk around the floor out there and look at the costumes and see how many of them have one-off Bluetooth adapters or what. That's always been our normal thing. If what you're worried about is the small batch, we're going to release 100 of these and not worry about it, and so we're not going to really make them securely. They're not making them securely when they make a million of them, so I would actually believe that it's probably better chance that they'll pay attention if they only make 100, but I don't know nothing.
Yeah, actually, kind of riffing on that better, it suddenly occurred to me that the diversity of large numbers of things that are all very different from each other is itself a protection.
Yeah. Yes. I saw the big orange box bounce.
We saw the mic fly, so. Who's got it?
Sorry. I know, I was ready. All right, so me and one of my friends were talking, and we were basically talking about basically the concept of hacking as a concept, and I was telling them, I tried to keep an open mind, I was trying to like, listen to what he was saying, but I was telling them that as long as we use technology to stop people from committing crimes, people will always use technology to find another way to commit a crime. So I was asking, we were talking about it, and he was saying that in the near future, there might be a chance that hacking as a general concept and the ability to basically use someone's someone's data like against them and to basically use like a system the way it wasn't intended to be used might disappear in general. And I was denying it, but I started to think about things like Mac and like how big like an issue of like malware was in the past, and the fact that this might actually be true. And my question was like, how you guys feel about that?
You know, one of the things that you kind of brush on is using systems that they're not intended, like unintended use of them, and you're getting into the realm of terms of use. Which I think is really a simple concept, right? If I use Facebook in the wrong way, putting up a quiz that takes everybody's data and steals it and puts it in a huge thing and does analysis on it, and then I am able to sell it to people that are doing voting analysis, and now I've got Cambridge the Cambridge
Analytica,
there we go. That's a terms of use issue, right? Is that, were they really hacking Facebook? Right?
No.
Were they hacking yourself? Is that, they're in that gray area of like, well, it was unintended consequences of not really, being specific about it. You're supposed to use it, right? And that's there's a lot that's a lot of the gray area that we're a lot of these players play in, and some of them are valid companies doing valid work, and then some of them are Russian mobsters trying to steal money or steal intelligence. That is a gray area that a lot of people play in.
Sorry, I need to say something. This is a pet peeve of mine. Cambridge Analytica was not a gray area. Cambridge Analytica used the data exactly like Facebook intended the data to be used. I'm sorry, it's a pet peeve because people say, not you, you didn't say this, but see, people say stupid shit like Russians hacked the election because Cambridge Analytica broke into Facebook. I want to be clear, he did not say that, but people say that. In 2007, Tom Esten and I stood up on stage at DEF CON and released Social Zombies. We released Social Butterfly, which was an API-driven application that was front-ended by a variety of systems specifically to show people how fast you could collect data, just like Cambridge Analytica did it. And what we had Facebook engineers in the room. I had an app we built called Kanye Westify. And basically all it did was it took your friend's latest status and posted it back and said, I'm going to let you finish, but Beyonce had the best that person's status ever. It was the stupidest damn thing ever. On the back end, it collected all the data of the user, all the data of the friend, all the data of the other friends, all the data of their friends of friends, and collected it. We presented that to Facebook, and Facebook said, yep, that's the way it's supposed to be used. Right. Yeah. That was in 2007. So
That's why I say, sorry not to be rude, not a gray area, right? Yeah. Exactly how the app was viewed. But the gray area, which I don't think is gray either because I think it's just black, it's wrong, is what they did with it afterwards, right? Like, so, yeah, sorry, pet peeve.
Yeah, no, it's a very good point. The thing is, like, when we talk about, you know, hacking as like, you know, misuse of a system, you know, there's lots of, like, there's just angles you take. It's like, oh, well, that's obviously wrong. Well, no, you know, according, if you actually read the legal language, nope. We're good, right? No, we're good. We're in the right. And you know, we're just a matter of perspective. You know, what you think would be absolutely, that's hacking. It's not. Yeah. And then if you flip it to the other side, it's like, hey, I'm enumerating. There's a guy that went and found a vulnerability with AT&T's system with the iPhones and said, hey, look, I can get all the users, right? And the guy was a dickhead. So we'll not get into details.
The guy was
such an asshole.
Self-identified Nazi.
Yeah, he was. But I mean, the point was, is you know, he found a vulnerability and you know, just enumerated users and said, hey, this is you know, and he did a good bit of it, and he got arrested for it, right? And then that was, you know, that's another misuse of you know, just like, all right, now take it from the other perspective, and now I'm arrested. And so it can go both ways.
Wasn't there also a guy in Canada who did a similar enumeration attack on, well, not attack, but enumeration on public government data and got in legal trouble for it?
Yeah, the big difference between the guy in Canada and Weave. Jackhole, the guy in Canada enumerated through government data that is supposed to be public anyways. Weave enumerated through data that was public but not supposed to be, and then there's a step that is often left out. He then tried to extort money from AT&T to not tell anybody he had found this data. AT&T said, screw you, hippie, and he released the data, and then he got arrested, right?
Yep, Unless we want to keep going with the moderator.
Let's go ahead and do some demos, hold your questions for a few minutes, and we'll come back to them, okay?
So it seemed like the premise here with some of the concept of the demo is to allow for the audience to kind of understand what is going on behind a hack. So I'm actually going to like show the hack running. This is not actually quite a demo, but I'm going to show you in like how it works. And some of these are very, very simple. So when the G1 came out, the first Android phone, the question was, like, it actually was as locked down as an iPhone. And the question was, would somebody come up with a jailbreak for it? And a little bit later, so there was an SSH client for it, somebody filed a bug saying that when you typed reboot in order to reboot a remote computer, like you were logged into your remote computer and you typed reboot, that somehow your local phone rebooted. And so the bug was, you know, what steps will reproduce the problem? Connect to a remote Unix machine, call reboot to reboot the remote machine. The remote machine reboots as well as the phone. What is the expected output? What do you see instead? Expected output is reboot the remote computer. Instead, the remote computer is rebooted as well as the phone. So it turns out what was going on is that they had a console attached to the physical hardware keyboard on the G1. That was logged in as root at all times, and everything you were typing in was being mirrored to that console. So what was the really neat thing about this is they also happened to ship a Telnet daemon. So all you had to do was anywhere in the system, just hit enter, Telnet D, enter, and then you could Telnet into your phone as root. And this is a one-line fix to disable the root console attached to the the hardware keyboard. Shell shock, which was mentioned earlier. Shell shock is a bug in Bash, although you could argue whether it's a bug or not. The premise is that you can have functions in Bash. Functions have names, they have, in parentheses, they've got arguments, and they've got code. Here the code is just this colon, semicolon. You can take variables and export them so that when you run other programs, they will have access to the same variables that you currently have access to. But you can also export functions, which is lesser known. So if you export -f, here we've exported this whole function. But you only have the ability, so the way that these variables are, is the variables have names, and then variables have values, which is a small bit of text. what the shell has to do is it has to convert your function into a small bit of text in order to be able to export it to the later programs. There's a program called printenv, which will show us all of the variables, and here we can see that there's a variable named x, and it the string of text that it assigns it is what we might call a normalized or canonicalized version of the function. It is open parenthesis, close parenthesis, which is where those arguments would have been from before, followed by space, squiggly brace, and then a normalized version formatted carefully what the code would be. Now, every time a shell would run, it goes through all the variables and it simply looks for variables that begin with open parenthesis, close parenthesis, space, open squiggly brace, and it then interprets that as a function by taking the name of the variable, putting it before the entire text of the value of the variable, and just running it as if it were code. So, now what you can do is you can construct variables that contain, after the closed squiggly brace of the function, any arbitrary other code, such as running the program date. And if you simply export that into the environment and run bash, it will it will end up not only instantiating the function, but it will also run whatever extra code you injected there. This became a bug because there were there happens to be, and you could argue then whose bug is this really, web programming environments that would take all of the HTTP headers that you would pass via your web browser will tell it what the will tell, for example, the server what the user agent is, what the name of the web browser you're using. It will send the current date. And then the web programming environment took all of those, turned them into environment variables, and then would run a program which you might have heard of the term CGI script. And if that CGI script ever indirectly ran bash, which it might oftentimes do in order to run other programs, then this injection would occur and you'd be able to inject anything you wanted to onto running on that web server. Now this is where Brian will argue that when he wrote bash, the only way you could construct an environment variable is by locally typing it into your computer. And if you locally type that variable into your own computer and then run a shell, why is that an issue? It was arguably the introduction of the internet and this broken web framework allowing you to have environment variables without realizing the ramifications of environment variables that leads to this bug. But this is Brian. And this bug actually ended up winning what's known as a Pony Award, which is it's an award that is given at DEF CON for the most overhyped bug of a year. This is a bug that was like, well, it's going to take down the entire internet. And in fact, it is very rare that you will find in 2016 or whatever this was a computer running a CGI server that was indirectly running a bash script that was in a position to do anything terribly important. I'm going to skip here to... I just have like a bunch of slides that I have for various forms of bugs. So, go-to-fail is a bug that you may have heard of. Go-to-fail was a famous issue that inspired T-shirts written about the bug. So this was a bug in the SSL certificate parsing on the iPhone, and the bug literally was that here is the code. You will notice that we have an if statement followed by a function we call, we get, so ERR, we're getting the error, we're setting the error equal to that, and then at the end, if the error was not equal to zero, which means that there was an error, we go to fail. And we do another line of code, and if there's an error, we go to fail. Another line of code error, go to fail. And then suddenly we just have go to fail, go to fail. Somehow go to fail ended up in the code base twice. The thought process here is that there was a very complicated merge operation between multiple developers working on the software at the same time who had introduced different sections of code. Somebody went through, made some, agreed to this change, that change, verified it compiled, verified that it looked like it worked, and then committed it back, but accidentally ended up with two go-to fails in a row. The way that the C programming language here works is that the indentation there is not important, and so the second go-to fail will always run, and what it does is it just skips the rest of the code. And then at the end it says return error, but there was no error. ERR is marking as no error, and so it returns as if there was no issue at all, and it just skipped all of the verification of SSL entirely.
Oh, seriously?
Seriously. So there's a guy named J-Case who does a lot of Android exploitation work, and what his claim to fame is he'll go and he'll look in the initialization scripts of the phone and find essentially a distraught developer working at the phone company who had been dealing with the fact that the phone would occasionally turn on and not turn on. And then track it down to, oh, there's a folder on the somewhere in the file system that some very very critical process could not write to. And after spending hours, days, maybe even weeks trying to figure out what made that happen, finally just getting angry, going into the initialization script and saying chmod 777, which means everyone can write to this thing in any way they want, to whatever folder that what it was. If that folder is in an area of the file system that the user has any control over, they can do this glorious trick, which is to symlink it, to make leave a little file, which is just a little forwarding address to another file, and make it so that when this initialization script runs, they can turn any file into anyone can write to it, including protected driver operating system files that are stored on virtual file systems, allowing you to change what, for example, we used the USB hot plug script. So when you plug a USB device into a computer, there's a program that gets run, and if you can change what that program is, now you've got a lot of fun. I'm going to do another two of these that are really easy to kind of like visualize here. So here's the one is called Rage Against the Cage, which was a big exploit that was used on Android 2.2, I believe. It might have been 2.3. Rage Against the Cage, the bug in this code. So what this is in the Android debug bridge daemon. This is a something that gets run on the phone when you connect it over USB if you turn on developer mode, and allows you to use debugging tools to talk to the phone, get a shell. That shell is restricted, though. That shell is restricted to only have access to what is known as the shell user. And the way that that works is that there is a... there are functions in Unix which allow you to set the current user and set the current group. And so when the Android debug bridge would turn on, it would check, are we running in secure mode? If so, I will set my group ID to shell, and I will set my user ID to shell. Well, what it is that there's no error check here. There's an assumption that this will always succeed. And it turns out that there actually are cases where you can make it so that the setGID and setUID function calls don't work. And the big one is if you are out of processes. If you have a quota, is what it's called, where the user's only allowed to run 5 processes because you didn't want them to be able to run thousands of processes, and they already have 5 processes, and you try to turn your program into running as their user, well, it's going to fail because now they have 6 processes. And so the Rage Against the Cage, as you would do if you've ever heard of the term, there's a fork bomb. But you would run a program that's designed to just clone itself over and over and over again as the shell user, and then in the process ask the debug bridge to restart. And when it restarts, you will hopefully win and grow to take up all of the processes. The debug bridge will start up, try to switch to the shell user, fail, and then now the debug bridge is simply left running as the root user. This is maybe difficult to. I'm actually. This one's a fun enough thing that I'm going to fix the font here, not the color here, just to be. Yeah. All right. So this is a bug that was used to attack Android 2.0 on the Verizon Droid. Here's the challenge. You don't even have to program. That's the hint. Does anyone see the bug in this code? I really love it if the kid gets it.
I don't think there's a second parentheses on that if.
Okay, no, the comment was that there's a whether there isn't a closed parenthesis. So this code is well formed in the sense of its syntax. So we've got the if statement, open parenthesis, and then we've got these 4 clauses separated by the double ampersands for and then this closed parenthesis. The code is well formed.
Isn't that you're starting at 4 and looking to -3, but you're only adding?
No, that is the kind of thing that you might expect to look for is kind of like edge conditions. And so the idea here is that why are we starting at 4 and then kind of going back by 3 at a time? That is kind of weird, but it's not the bug. There's somebody over here who was saying something.
It checks for like the same thing to be equal.
Yeah. So you'll notice that there's like a pattern in the code here. EOCDI, EOCDI plus 1, EOCDI plus 2. EOCDI plus 1 again. It's like there's like a pattern of like 1, 2, 1, and that's the bug. There's if that second one were a 3, this code would work. And what this ended up allowing for is this was checking to make certain that there's this really weird corner case in the zip file format that you it allows you to have comments that are almost indistinguishable from part of the data. Like a comment is like an extra data you've attached in, and the signature, the security, the cryptographic security was simply stuck at the end of the file, and you could hide parts of that inside of the comment block if the signature happened to contain certain bytes, and that's where this check ended up occurring. But it's just, I think it's interesting, there's so many variety of tiny simple mistakes. Like it's like one line of code that somebody got wrong. That they added a line of code they shouldn't have, they made a one character typo, they didn't check for an error condition, that lets us get complete control over the system. It doesn't have to be an architectural mistake, it doesn't have to be a back door in the system. Like I could actually argue, by the way, that if somebody says like, oh, are there any back doors in the system? This could have been a back door. If you're gonna leave a back door, leave this. This has got perfect plausible deniability that this was a typo. Whereas if you go and you leave code that says, if somebody leaves the, like types in the password, ha 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 ha, I own you, then I will get control of your, no, that you know, there's no deniability for that.
So there was, wasn't there recently a new iPhone jailbreak, like a long time that we haven't had a recent jailbreak and.
So we've actually we've been getting jailbreaks pretty consistently. Okay. Minor versions have gone by now. We don't have jailbreaks, but almost all jailbreaks now come from, there's one guy who works at Google on Google Project Zero named Ian Beer, and he goes above and beyond every time by not just coming up with what the bug is, not just by coming up with the proof of concept that sort of works, but by doing an end-to-end weaponization for iOS and then releasing it right after Apple fixes it. And releases it as open source in a way that is typically quite easy to integrate into a jailbreak tool. But so we've had those. The fun thing that occurred recently with iOS 12.4 is that Apple actually made a reversion. Like they accidentally reintroduced a bug they had already fixed for iOS 12.1.
Okay.
And reintroduced it in 12.4.
Yep.
Regression. Regression. That's the term.
Good old regression. Yeah. All right. That's what I thought. There was something along those lines.
Go ahead.
Hey, we got a box.
Oh, yeah. Does anybody need a question? Yeah.
Turn it up. Is the box on? All right.
Box on.
Yep.
Okay.
As an old time programmer, I might not be the oldest guy here, but I'm pretty close. As you say, one of the things is when you've got 47,000 different small little bits, it's a lot harder to write something that'll attack all of them. And another thing that I was going to say was about your comment about why they don't fix certain things. In the last 40 years, we've gone from C to Java, C++ to C# and Java, to Java and JavaScript and C++ or C#, and variations of usage of all of those that change constantly. And I'm sure there are other things being used too.
Go.
The steady change of things means that if you spend too much time trying to clean out all the little bugs for this, you spend an awful lot of money that 5 years from now won't be relevant, because none of those tools will be used anymore. I'm not saying we shouldn't do it, but it is one of the arguments from the business side of things why it doesn't pay, it's not cost effective, because things are in too fast a state of flux for them to really care that much. It's not the chance of them getting hit by something during that 5-year span where all those tools are vulnerable or relevant doesn't exist, you know, isn't going to happen.
And part of why we might need regulation, because you can imagine, for example, somebody making the same argument about, I'm only going to be selling this car for like 3 years. Do I really need to crash testing on it?
Yeah.
I'm not saying I defend it. I'm saying that's the business argument.
Yeah, and you know, it was some of the discussion we've had earlier. You know, it comes down to threat modeling, right? You know, those business decisions need to be made around the threat model. If it's not around threat model, it's just what's ever the cheapest, right?
Yep.
And then you can, you, if you're still trying to push a secure programming program, then you talk about, you know, it's cheaper to fix bugs earlier on, and you try to get those technologies and processes in place, you know, early. But that, you know, if you don't have threat models, then you're sitting around going, you know,
regulation, I would argue,
perhaps more indemnification might be more important. It may cost them if they don't.
So here's a part of the issue with what you said, though. Not your statement, but what they're saying is this idea that they retire things in 5 years is crap. Right? I mean, there's not just Williams XP, right? But beyond that, the solutions to the problems don't actually care in most cases whether you're using Java or Ruby or Python or even the read once, the write once, read never language Perl. Handling data correctly, handling your application correctly is the same across the board. So I think that every single time you hear from somebody, we can't fix that because we're going to retire it soon, and we can't do it right because we're going to change the way we do it. Those are people who don't truly understand what they're doing, and your job, because I know you said you weren't agreeing with them, your job is to make sure that they understand why they're wrong. Right?
But again, one of my things that I'm concerned, I don't like the idea of regulation.
Oh, I hate the idea of regulation.
I think indemnification is a much better approach. Make it something where their own cost model require them to do it.
Well, and that's... in my opinion, that's a job of the people buying the product, the people building the product, and the people that are managing this stuff.
Well, and it's also the legislature and the justice. Things when a judge says, no, you can't sue somebody over that, they're protected over something.
Yeah, I every single time you say, let's get the government to fix this.
I think the question here that I have, though, is that if it's the market incentives here are poor. Like, I mean, like you said, this indemnification. I mean, like, first of all, I mean, the word strikes me as weird because when you said it, I'm immediately like, so we're going to indemnify them for the failures in security? Yeah. Like, it's going to come from the people are going to pay for the fact that it's still going to be, like...
I'm talking about making companies that aren't caring about this to make them pay because they didn't care.
Now, how do you do that without regulation?
Equifax still not... But it's got to do with how you do the regulation.
Yeah, okay.
No.
I think he's arguing against the government solution.
Totally against regulation in this case.
Right.
Liability.
Totally. Liability. Here's the problem is, if you look at the regulation that's already there, most of the regulation around software and liability and everything else have actually put us in the case we're in, right? Equifax, we can pick on Equifax what you want. Who do you believe passed the funding for most of Equifax's stuff? The government.
But would you say the same thing about the regulations that keep toy makers from essentially leaving large, sharp sticks in the middle of it?
Right.
Or the regulations about flammability of certain kinds of children's clothing?
We lost that. I mean, that's basically, you know, the consumer protections that we've lost. We don't buy products from software companies.
Right.
We license them.
And that's why it's different.
Right.
Because if we want to talk about the regulation, you're absolutely right. The regulation that said don't put a sharp stick, right, in a bed makes sense, right? Because you bought the bed, right? But that same regulation is why when you walk up to any building in California, there is a sign on the outside of the building that says this building may contain chemicals that are known to cause cancer in California. It's because the regulation was written by people who didn't understand what they were doing. When you talk about the regulation for the car industry, it wasn't written by Congress. It was written by the various organizations under the executive branch that put forth, we're going to start doing seatbelts, we're going to start doing this. And that effort is there. That effort is being worked. The Small Business Administration has been doing a software bill of materials for a decade now. The SBOM stuff. People need to just start doing it.
Would you not call, though, what has occurred in that car industry regulation?
I have, but you buy your car. You don't buy your software.
Doesn't that almost mean that we need stronger regulation?
Do you honestly believe that the politicians that we have in power right now, and I don't care your politics. I'm not picking on a specific side, right?
Yeah.
My problem is that when we say, a great example, net neutrality. Right? We passed regulation that exempted mobile device carriers and anybody who wasn't considered high speed, right?
So the response I have for this is that there's two issues, essentially. There's the issue of whether or not you believe that the regulation that we end up getting is good. And then there's separately the question of whether or not we could even solve these problems if we did not have good regulations. See, that concern that I have is from the perspective of the market economy, the incentives are so misaligned that unless you do something as a realignment by forcing an externality to actually be paid by somebody, yep, which will require regulation, whether you make it so that there is a
that
liability
that
is, maybe I think we okay, then I think there's, yeah, some kind of question we have on where the term what regulation, I'm just mean a law has to get changed.
I understand that. And okay. I don't believe that a law has to be changed for us to sue a company for doing stuff that's negligent, doing stuff that exposes us to things. That's already been shown with Equifax. They were sued. The regulation prevented them from paying out something that would actually be useful, right? So the regulation prevented that indemnification. Now, I don't think that's the right word, but I'll use it, right? We see way too often where we're not doing the right thing as people to demand what we need to and to hold companies accountable. I personally believe that if we actually said we're going to hold that accountable, things would change. And we've seen things change based on that. We've seen more and more companies that have to show what they're doing with security because their customers are demanding it. In B2B, while I already gave a crappy example, we see lots of good things come out of that. None of that required regulation. And my worry is that the regulation that did come out would be so piss poor, it would cause more problems. That's why I'm against regulation, right?
Okay, we do have some more questions. Get the mic real quick so we can have it recorded.
Yeah, sorry. One more thing, just in the same line. One of the things you're missing, though, is that there is a third party involved that's relevant to the whole liability question. Yes, the liabilities, and that is the insurance companies, because the insurance companies, they give a shit about whether or not these companies are fulfilling their liability requirements, because they're paying for their liability.
To some extent. I mean, yeah, to cover their own ass.
It's a matter of getting the whole thing working properly more than just, you know, I'm trying to say is there are other things, other ways to do this that may fix it as well better than
have you looked at
laws.
A cyber liability policy?
Yeah. Yeah. So, cyber liability policies are right now funding, you know, ransomware.
They're horribly bad. I agree. But that's what I'm trying to say is part of the whole thing is that those the fact that the law allows those policies to be the fact that the justice system allows those policies to be applicable is part of the issue. Whether that gets solved by the legislature or the judiciary is an interesting question.
I think that one of the interesting takeaway is proving harm, right? And that, you know, yes, I was involved in the Equifax, right? I cannot prove harm, right? I can't sit there and say here's exactly how, yeah, I was harmed, because you know it's just too complex, right? Yeah, I just can't go up and say I was, you know, somebody punched me in the face because this happened, right? You know, I don't have any harm. But with the ransomware, you do. And in that case, I think that it's where we're starting to actually be able, if we can leverage that and be able to show harm from that, that could actually help turn the tide. But it's the injection of the insurance thing has just really changed that.
I think you underestimate how much insurance regulations affect what goes into a car and what doesn't go into a car.
All right, we do have some more questions, so let's get to them.
This no, let's move off of regulation for right now.
Yeah.
I feel bad about having continued as long as I did. So.
Yeah.
Sir, you really stepped in it there on that question.
All right.
This isn't my question, but I'll make a comment. I practice law for a living, and when I read my cyber liability policy, if I complied with the terms and conditions, 98% of my risk was gone. Literally, when I looked at it, I'm scratching my head saying, why do I need to insure it if I've jumped through the hoops that you've asked me to? Just an interesting note. Total side question. I'd love to know, from like a personal reality standpoint, what worries you or keeps you up at night most about the electronic world we live in to you personally, and do you have any solutions for that? I'd love to start with Kevin and just hear from the panel.
Okay. What is my biggest worry with the electronic worlds that we have? People are too fucking noisy. We complain about things, and then we freak out about things that have nothing to do with any reality. And those things prevent forward progress. And I'll use a horrific example. I believe that deepfakes is a disgusting piece of software that should have never seen the light of day. But on the same hand, deepfakes is one step toward holodecks. Right? If we're not able to real-time change what the person or thing is seeing and saying, then we're not going to have holodecks. Now, does that mean I'm okay with deepfakes? No. But the problem is that we freak out about, oh my gosh, this is awful because of this, and then anything even sort of related is immediately shot down, right? And we see that time and time again. I see the same thing with privacy, with GDPR, right? I see time and time again, we have a move forward with technology that we take one step forward and two steps back because people get worried about what's going to happen. And I'm worried about what's going to happen, but I do believe, and maybe I'm stupid, but I believe that in most cases, I'll even say all cases, the technologies we build ultimately are used for good rather than bad. And we need to focus on the using for them for good. That's what I'm worried about.
I'm a software focused person.
Nope. Mike.
Eat the mic.
There you go.
Here.
I'll trade. So I'm a software-focused person. I do software. I it's not as large scale a thought process. It's very more, much more focused on that when it comes to kind of our electronic world. As a developer, as someone who's been a developer for a long time, I think people are dealing with a lot more complexity now than they used to be. I think moving towards serverless environments, cloud processing. Containerized microservice architecture, all sorts of stuff like that. Developers are dealing with more and more complexity, and the security resources and training just aren't keeping up with it. To me, it seems like they're one step behind, and tomorrow they'll be two steps behind, and just generally trying to keep up is making the world of software risky.
I'm extremely concerned about how we've been just computerizing everything. I mean, we now have
verifying,
but it's cool.
We now have software sex toys, right? I mean, we have. It's just I was checking to make sure. He's gone. it's gone to the point where the we're just putting internet attached, Bluetooth attached computers in absolutely everything, running software that doesn't really work. And I and the idea that we don't seem to be responsible with that during this period when all of our software is insecure is just terrifying to me. When I know people who are constantly finding 0 days in these projects.
Yeah, I'm also a software guy. I love the answer about complexity. And along the same lines, what keeps me up is speed. So in the DevOps world, with the rate in which companies now are building software and shipping it at insane speeds, we have customers that are shipping hundreds of apps a day, literally, like large companies that are doing that. And it's like, how is that security testing happening? And we have, our product SCA, Static Code Analyzer, so companies are embedding that within their build process, or trying to, so every time they hit build, as part of that build process, security testing is being done. And they complain, you know, they're trying to scan hundreds of thousands of lines of code, and they say, 6 hours, that's too long, we don't have time for that. It's, okay, well then you don't test your software, it takes time, security takes time, and companies are really rushing. So along with the complexity, and the speed, you put those two together, and it's really tough to keep up on the security side of things.
I always think about as you build a life and a history, and how you look back and think about the things that you've done in your life. You know, we used to build photo albums, right? And the scary thing about, like, hearing somebody's house burn down and all of their, you know, family photo albums, you know, that history just being destroyed. With this digital world, you know, we rely on these third-party companies to store our life, right? So I got kids, we take lots of photos, you know, over the years, you know, lots and lots of digital content, right? And where do I trust that content to? And you know, if I don't sit there and replicate across different, you know, systems, all it takes is, you know, one type of mistake, either a malicious hacker, you know, finding, you know, one of my accounts that happened to be, you know, on you know, have I been pwned, right? You know, or one of the systems that I'm on think that I'm doing something wrong and take away my access. People lose access to their history and their life. And it's really amazing how people are so devastated by that loss. And so what are we, you know, soaking into, you know, our digital, you know, our life, is we're putting so much online, and we're, you know, that's my threat model, right? I think I don't worry about my bank account, right? I've got protections in place. If I see, you know, fraudulent charges, I can get that back. But if my, you know, photo, and this has happened to me, is I've had, you know, 10 years of you know, photos and videos, you know, disappear, and that, you know, is can really be devastating. As more and more of our next generation put most of our lives into, is very, you know, intangible and can disappear very quickly.
And one thing I can say you should also worry about, show of hands, who uses Kaspersky? Okay. Are you aware that Kaspersky does a lot of tracking? And there was actually an article that I read not that long ago talking about they embedded a separate UUID into each web page that was unique to the user.
I've worked with Kaspersky on automating
Mike. Hi. Pass him the microphone, please. Who has it?
Yeah.
Okay, what was that?
I work with Kaspersky from an IT perspective on automating its removal from enterprise systems.
Okay.
I don't actually.
I just heard I work with Kaspersky. Okay. I was going to kick you out of the fucking room.
No. Sorry.
His name is Dimitri, and.
Don't always trust your antivirus. There's a lot of them out there that do track you and bring up statistics and can personally identify you.
Yeah.
All right, next question.
All.
I don't even use an antivirus.
I don't either.
They just slow down your system, and it's not good.
Keeping things down, kind of on a downer, and we talked about Cambridge Analytica earlier, with pretty much every app on your phone tracking what you're doing, sending analytics to a separate server. What's the worst case? Well, what's the next step in the threat of that besides serving up ads on Facebook?
Have you left the country recently?
Me personally, no.
All right. So when you enter the U.S., they have the right to, you know, search your phone. All right. And there are instances where people are getting detained, you know, for the content on their phone, not from going to China, but going somewhere else and coming back to the United States. That is my worst case scenario. Is not so much, you know, worried about these foreign governments. Is that, you know, if I am posting stuff against my current president, is that going to get me detained and coming back into the United States?
Okay, let's, mic to the next person, then we'll pass it back to the Kaspersky guy.
So going back to when we were saying about either legislation or, you know, fitness of software and things like that, most of the companies that have had hacked have had PCI compliance. I've passed it, so that seems to be just fine. And then about how software is changing over time, maybe a question for the audience and then hit the panel is, hopefully everybody knows what buffer overflows are, and when was the first date that a buffer overflow was actually theorized and said this was going to be a security problem, and then why haven't we still fixed it?
If I could respond to the first part of what you said first.
Yep.
You have a factual error. You said that all companies that have been breached lately have been PCI compliant. That is 100% not true. And the reason it is 100% not true is the PCI Council holds very firmly to the idea that if you are breached, you are immediately out of compliance with the PCI standards.
I'm sorry, I'm British and it hasn't come out, but there was sarcasm dripping in that.
Oh, good. PCI Council is very proud of the fact, and I want to be very clear, I'm making fun of them for this.
Right.
They are very proud of the fact that no PCI compliant company has ever been compromised, and their weasel words work because the minute you're compromised, you're out of compliance.
Exactly.
Yeah. compliance is that you must be this tall to ride the internet.
Yeah. but maybe the thing that to help the audience is, so buffer overflows have been around for a long time. Why isn't software catching up and fixing them? But when was buffer overflows first theorized as a security flaw? And that will give people an idea about how bad security is that needs to be fixed and all the things you were talking about earlier.
1637.
ANSI C.
88 was the first documented exploitation.
Yeah.
72 was...
He looked that up.
he cheated. He used AI.
He implemented, your friend.
So this is great. I saw this online. He implemented a neural net to solve that problem. Which is he did it manually. He did himself.
I'm sorry?
72.
Yeah, that's what he said. Wasn't the first CVE... Let me rephrase that. Not the first CVE, but the oldest CVE, first security problem talked about was in the telegraph system? Wasn't the... It was a man-in-the-middle attack, right? Where they were able, the competitor was able to intercept the traffic, and that was a documented security flaw in. Yeah, exactly. We're not gonna fix it.
Arguably, the first hack in media was in the Count of Monte Cristo. He hacked the telegraph system.
Yeah.
It was only used by the government in France in the 1830s and 40s.
Good example, right? The reality is we're not going to fix security. And the other part of that reality is we don't have to be secure. We really don't. Because if our goal is to be secure, we're going to fail. Our job, our goal, is to be as secure as possible so that we can solve the problems or detect the attacks before they get in. That's our goal. And so we're never going to fix buffer overflows. We're never going to fix cross-site scripting. We're never going to fix all these problems. We just need to understand what we need to do to be better.
Next question.
Hello. So I'm a guy who started out doing IT work and doing remote support and this, that, and the other. And then I got into software development. And so I was fortunate in that one of the first companies I worked for, they actually did give me training OWASP Top 10, and we got taught how to use static code testing for development and whatnot. But one of the things that more recently keeps me up at night, and I wonder if it keeps you up at night too, is that one of the companies I worked for previously used a technology that Intel puts into business computers called vPro technology that allows you to access computers even when they're crashed to be able to recover them and whatnot. And I'm wondering, what do you think about hardware level vulnerabilities that are discovered on the year to year basis, and what can anyone do to protect themselves against those?
Stop using computers.
Yeah. So one of the things is like, I'm always worried about the APT, the advanced stuff. It's like, if you're going to get to that level, if you have to go to that degree, it's out of your control, right? You don't have to worry about that stuff. It's you step it down and really worry about, what your kids are doing, what your, you know, your family's doing, what you're, you know, it's really a lot more simple than that. Let's step back from the movie scripts and really understand, you know, what our real threat models are and understand what we should be worried about.
Yeah. That's what I was saying about the, we worry about things because they're making noise right now. Right? We have the attention span, I don't even want to say we have the attention span of a gnat, because that's insulting gnats, right? The next thing that comes in the news will worry us, and I'm not saying that hardware attacks aren't a problem. They absolutely are a problem, right? But you know what else you're running on top of that hardware? Facebook, right? You're running Windows, you're running Linux, you're running a Mac. There's so many layers of vulnerabilities that you've packaged up into a very nice shiny box, and I'm not sure that's the worry, because let's be blunt. Most attackers, including the mythical APT, are lazy. I'm not going to build a super secret double buffer format string overflow SQL injection, right? I'm going to send you an email with a link and get you to click it. Or I'm going to buy a FedEx uniform on eBay for $40. And walk into your office and steal that hardware you're worried about being vulnerable. Hell, wasn't it in Australia where they blew a hole in the side of the data center and forklifted two mainframes out? And nobody noticed until, like, the alerts started going off. Like, we can't get into Rack F. What do we do?
When was this?
Mainframe's down again. All right.
Yeah. When was that?
It was like 5 years ago or something, 10 years ago.
I have not heard about that.
You've never heard? They blew a hole in the side of a data center, went in with a forklift, and took two mainframes out. And I'm dead serious. I wasn't involved. That my understanding is that the first alerts were when somebody said, hey, I can't log into Rack F. I wonder why. And it was like, and my understanding, again, I'm repeating, right? But my understanding was somebody went to the data center and went, fuck, what's that?
Data center security in Australia, I do not want to host a system out of there.
Was the data center walls a NERC SIP compliant?
I have no, because it was Australia.
It was Australia, right?
Yeah, Australia. There's in Australia.
Were the walls made of kangaroos?
Yeah.
It's really funny to talk about, you know, like federal compliance.
Yeah.
When I've done foreign, you know, work. There are so many other, like, the rest of the world follows our, like, federal
cases.
Compliance way more than our actual government does.
Yeah.
It's like they love, you know, all of our compliance stuff. Like, yes, we're 100% compliant to U.S. federal compliance.
NIST 800-53.
Right, I'm like, but you're not in the U.S.
Did anybody hear about the ransomware attack in Baltimore?
Which one?
The one that brought the whole city down, but yes, which one? I agree. From what I understand, it's because they just simply didn't patch their systems.
Hey, no. Georgia State Patrol just got hit.
Really?
Yeah. I mean, we've had it's.
I don't think there's a state that doesn't have some government agency in the state, whether it's a city level. I mean, hell, in Oklahoma. Nathan told it. Nathan's one of our consultants. Nathan lives out in Oklahoma. In Oklahoma, they brought the 911 system down, and what they did was they took firemen and policemen and stationed them at Quick Trips. And it was like, okay, we're down right now, so if you have a fire or a police emergency, go to Quick Trip, which I guess is a convenience store or a gas station.
Yeah.
I don't know, like, go to Quick Trip and call the cop, right? And they literally put officers at these gas stations because the 911 system was down.
I'm on the Library Advisory Commission for... Oh, sorry.
No, I just... He's,
oh, MPCA adapted.
So I'm on the Library Advisory Commission for this city that's near where I live. And I receive an email when I get set up for everything. They've set up an email account for me. They send me an email saying what my username is, and they say that my password is the first character of my first name, uppercase, the second character of my first name, lowercase, the first character of my last name, you know, yada, 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 followed by, like, the number 65,000 pound sign. I'm just like... They did not write out the password. They wrote out the paragraph I just said. And I'm like, that does not sound like something that where they generated a password and emailed it to me, which is already kind of weird. This sounds like a pattern that everyone's password must be.
Yeah.
I know somebody on planning commission who will not be who will not mind if I do this, and I try logging into her. I can log into her email account. Okay. So does everyone in the entire city has this? Well, you know, it's probably the default password. I should at least go change my password. I go into the settings of the webmail system. I'm like, I don't see anywhere to change my password. I go and I find the instructions for the Outlook Web Access version. No, it's supposed to be like right here, except they seem to have disabled the password change feature because then I change the password and no, everyone's password must be the... yeah, some of the government security stuff is just ludicrous.
I will bet you if you look into that one... I know that in Florida they do that quite often because of sunshine laws, right? So, and their reasoning is they log into everybody's account and download the email to record it so that to be in compliance with the sunshine laws.
So the way that they really should do that sort of thing.
Oh, is, I know. Oh, yeah. I wasn't excusing it. I was just pointing out how great regulation was.
I think Kaspersky had a question.
Oh, no, I'm not that guy.
Oh, you got the mic right now. Okay, go ahead.
I am nearly not as tall as that guy.
He's Russian.
I'm not. All right, so kind of what, I guess a couple things. So what keeps me up at night is, unfortunately, we all like our, like, quadcopters and image stabilization systems and all that fun stuff, but the same technology that enables that also... unfortunately enables ICBMs and high velocity unmanned one-way UAVs, you know, stuff like that. That's kind of what I do for a living. So my thought, or I guess my question was, is anybody here familiar with automotive qualification for anything that goes in a car? Anybody? So one guy. So basically, if you write any software for an automotive device that runs firmware, you have to test every single, you're supposed to test every single possible case that the software can be put in. The problem is that when you throw something like autonomous navigation with machine learning, how do you do that? Because by nature, you can't. So that's the first question. The second question is, now a lot of these autonomous vehicle applications rely on a sense of trust, right? I'm going to trust that the IMU that's giving me a heading is going to always provide me with a heading. And that communication standard is either going to be CAN or SPI or I don't know, I2C or RS-45, RS-232, whatever, what have you. So the problem there is because the system that is actually creating the data, providing the data by nature is random, right? In theory, you know, inertial data is always going to be random to an extent. How can we trust that data? How do you know that the data coming out of the IMU is truly the data that is supposed to be coming out of the IMU?
So can I ask you a question?
Yeah.
So I've thought a lot about this, right? Because I've got a good friend, Matt Carpenter, who's done a lot of work in car hacking. You know, Charlie Miller's got some great stuff that he's done. We've all talked about this idea of autonomous cars and oh man, you know, that car that, you know, if you watch the news, a Tesla got hit by a bus. And the headline was Tesla in accident with a bus. Mm-hmm. Wasn't until like three quarters of the way down the article did they say, oh yeah, the bus ran a red light and slammed into the side of the Tesla, right? Okay. We worry about autonomous cars. Mm-hmm. I want you to look around. How many people here have a driver's license? Okay, now, sorry. How many people have gone through a training class on driving? I don't mean you took a test or something like that. How many people went through a class? Okay, great, more often. It must be a rule up here. In Florida, it's not required. So let me ask you, I'll point at you, sir. Good point. Okay, so, sir, I'll pick on you, sir, because you raised your hand. How old are you?
43.
When did you get your driver's license?
60.
Okay, when did you take the class?
25.
Okay. Was it from a DUI?
I did take the high school driver's ed.
Okay.
Which was also a class, but then okay. I took some right. advanced stuff later.
How many times when you're driving do you go the wrong way even though the GPS told you to take that left? Your GPS. So your GPS recalculates a lot, right? My GPS actually gets frustrated. Like, the wording changes. Like, fine, I'll recalculate again. If we can't trust all of them to get the data right, why do we expect the IMU to always get it right? And I'm not saying that we shouldn't attempt to, right? I would feel way safer if 80% of the cars or more were autonomous than I feel right now driving around.
Right.
Right? No.
You're all by neural death right now, though.
Yeah. I mean, so we can definitely, I'm sure we'll talk about this later, but I don't disagree. My question is more, is not, you know, is IMU going to be right or wrong? Because, I mean, we can go into the physics later, I promise.
Yeah.
But what I'm saying is there is an inherent trust that the IMU will always give you believable data. That's what I'm saying. The protocol that's really used, the underlying base protocol that's used to just extract data from the sensor, is not really secure. And when I say it's not secure, I mean right. literally any IMU product on the market right now falls under that category. So in an autonomous application, in a life critical application, what happens when we cross that boundary of a lot of autonomous vehicles on the road and then all of a sudden, you know, data's wrong, right?
I don't think we're in any different case
right.
than we are right now with a whole bunch of people who are listening to the radio, talking on the phone, texting their friends, haven't had their coffee, didn't sleep in 3 days. How many people after partying all weekend here at Dragon Con are driving home? Right? I mean, those systems absolutely should be secure.
Right.
Absolutely should be secure.
Right.
They're not going to be.
Nope.
Ever. Yeah.
So, I guess you guys wanted...
Yeah, pass it back to Kaspersky.
He doesn't want it.
He doesn't want it, okay. I'm not making fun of you. Okay.
or he's afraid to be identified.
That could be.
It's okay, Dimitri.
No, I wanted to go back to something. I forget which of you were speaking of about it, but the added complexity involved in containerizing a lot of things. I think it was you that yeah. And I've run into this at work sometimes, and I wanted to kind of get an idea of where developers are coming from on this, because the impression I get is that a lot of the drive toward containerization is developers trying not to be sysadmins.
Mm-hmm.
And sometimes that extends to trying to pretend that the local system doesn't actually exist. I can see the argument for that in terms of, like, it's less work if you don't have to worry about the local system. On the other hand, last year I got handed a containerized app where to troubleshoot, and I had trouble finding the logs because the developer had put them under Etsy. because it was in a container and he didn't need to care where he put it. And I'm kind of wondering how this sort of thing happens, and does it engender bad habits, and who do I need to punch to make those bad habits not happen?
It's not the network.
It's DNS. It is the network.
It's DNS. It's always DNS. Containers.
Don't punch the sysadmin who put logs in Etsy.
It was the developer that did. The app had been written to put its logs under Etsy.
Okay.
Because it was never designed to be run anywhere other than a container where they could get away with that, because it wasn't nuking any... It wasn't...
I'm not sure that anything kind of new or different has been created there, though. Developers creating bugs is not new. And they're always going to find a way to do it. I know I put a lot of crappy code into production running, you know, trading platforms that drive Wall Street. It happens. It's going to happen. They're going to keep doing it. Now they have a few new ways to do it, but ultimately it hasn't changed the landscape significantly.
But it does hand off the you know, who's building those middleware components, right? And like I said, it's not sysadmins, it's the developers who may not know how to set up a proper, you know, SQL or Python or environment or whatever the container is. That middleware, you know, is that's where we've had problems. Is that the developers putting out these containers that supposedly are okay? If we had set them up like we already set up like a normal enterprise app, we would do these, you know, all these things, and the architect would build this, engineer build this, right? But now it's just all in a container, right? And so actually, the people that know how to run those middleware things don't even get to see inside those containers.
So what's stopping you from providing the base container?
Because it's just a new process, right? It's just like one of those. It's like it's a magical container box, right? That does it, like my vendor gave me a container.
I agree,
right?
that concern is real. That the container, that's one less thing the developer thinks they have to worry about, right? My code runs, I'll shove it in this container, but what rights does that user inside that container have? What volume mappings are happening there? I don't know, my code works. It's an OS.
Or does the internal structure of the container make any sense to begin with? I mean, it may work, but not match any normal design patterns.
I will tell you that in my opinion, one of the main reasons we see a drive to containerization is because sysadmins have been a pain in the ass to developers for years. Right?
That's a very good point.
And I'll tell you,
unrepentant.
I was that system admin, right? I was the Webster administrator at Blue Cross of Florida, and I know that when I wanted to stand up a system, there was a process the developer had to go through. And I will tell you that every single one of my developers, if they had been given a choice to build their own container and shove that crap into my servers, they would have, right? And I will tell you that every single one of us security people need to take the example of sysadmins being removed because containers have been done because they stood in the way, and stop standing in the way ourselves, right? Because they're going to do the same thing to us.
Yeah.
I do believe that containers cause problems, and the problem isn't because of containerization. It's because we have alienated the developers so much, they're not asking us how to build them. They're just running down that path. So Mike's comment is exactly right. Why aren't we providing those base containers to them? Why aren't we giving them the standards? The fact that you had a developer that put logs in Etsy, I agree with you. That's one of the stupidest things I've heard in a while, right? But it's stupid to us because we know Etsy isn't where logs go, right? We know where they belong, and so it was dumb. The reality is, I'll guarantee you that developer was already building configs in Etsy, and so they just created a directory for the logs because in their mind it didn't matter. And reality is, as long as we got it communicated from them, you didn't, right? It wouldn't have mattered, right? I think we need to do a better job, as Mick said, we need to do a better job of providing the standards, providing the baseline, stop giving people a moving target.
And also lock out Docker.
Really quickly, I couldn't find the image quickly when I was just looking for it, but I saw this great like meme image, which was somebody saying, so I found a bug in your system, and saying, I don't know, it works on my computer, and that's the solution. Ah, well, we'll just ship your computer. And that is when containers... And that is when containers were born.
Yes.
And this is why, as the network guy, I shut down Docker Hub.
So, did you just say you shut down Docker Hub?
Well, no, hypothetically, but I mean, like Docker Hub, you're pulling unknown binaries into a system and developing against them. That's kind of a, you know, you talk about.
Do you also block Windows Update?
I'd love to. But
I'm just saying, like it would be the same thing, right?
No, but. You know, look, I work for an old AS, right? And we used to run a system called Track, where we had trusted sysadmins build the packages, who they, you know, would pull in .configure, make build, make deploy, and then put it up in a tarball for systems to pull down. Because we told the university, don't just download packages, you know, pull it from our trusted repo.
So we ran a repo like back in the 90s. So, you know, when you trust others' binaries, are you really reviewing the code, or are you just kind of pushing the trust down the chain? And when it breaks, it breaks. So a lot of the internet works on just, you know, apt-get or yum update or you know whatever. It's the same thing with Docker pull, and you just trust that the guy who built the Docker container or the Docker image or whatever got it right and didn't put something stupid in there, which is going to get you owned like 2 weeks down the road.
But that's where we go back to the same conversation about how much time do you have to dedicate something, right?
Right.
And this running is where, critical infrastructure for my institution.
Right. How many people here run Gentoo? Does Gentoo even still exist, right? Like the...
I think it does.
You know?
He does.
But you do. You run it?
Yes.
Is that the old...
No, the gentleman behind you. You run Gentoo?
Yes.
Do you have any other hobbies?
I scripted most of it out.
So you don't run Gentoo. You run your scripts.
Yeah.
So I have scripts that run through the updates, and when that gets too, like, messed up, I have another script that will just suck all of the settings out and spit out a new cheroot that I then use gparted to just move it around.
So you play yourself the very small shell script. Congratulations.
Yeah. She's right.
Yep.
What?
One of the things this gets down to is that the reason that we introduce friction in with security, right, is to allow people to double check their work, right? And I need my developing team, all my technologists, to do stuff quickly, right? They're the smart people that are gonna solve the problems, right? I'm the security guy, I'm the blue team, right? I'm there to like, where do I need to like put my checks and balances in? Docker Hub is a great place to get tons of stuff to develop quickly and figure out, you know, what's going to work and what's not going to work. And so where do I need to go and check that stuff? You know, it's different for every situation. You know, I'm not going to say here's the way to solve it, but you have to look at it and say, where do I put in the checks and balances? And we need to make sure as you know, security team is we need to enable our technologists to do the things they want to do. If they want to do containers, we need to enable that, right? Like we need to give them base images. We need to figure out what is it that we need to do to make sure that the people that want to build the solutions that are going to make the company run do the thing that we can't just sit there and say no, you can't get Docker Hub, right?
Well, that's just and to be frank, no, we didn't actually lock down Docker Hub. We're a university, but. You know, there's code I write, which is not production, like very not production. I'm an old Fortran guy. Like, I'm learning Python. Don't let me near production. But I do proof of concept.
Now, just to do Perl, it's better.
No, it's not. I've been drinking with Randy.
We can't rag on Randall right now. He's not here to defend himself.
I know. Where's Randall?
I've been drinking with Randall.
I didn't hear anybody make fun of Randall.
Invisible
we just
man.
Made fun of Perl.
Oh, so everybody knows pizza is physically here. We're waiting on it to come up. So we'll be breaking here shortly, probably.
But, you know, so to your question, though, anything I write, no production. I hope there would be a team of production quality coders who could look at kind of my proof of concept and go, okay, we can codify that and write it right for a ground up rebuild. But
no, nobody's going to do
the
that.
The stuff I do, I mean.
It's going straight into production.
It works. I try to straight keep it away from production. Yeah.
So there was a hand up in the
question
back.
Question back here.
Way in the back.
Ooh. Oh!
Oh! One day without an injury at Hacking 201.
So,
pizza.
And there is much rejoicing.
Yeah. I have a follow-up question back to the autonomous cars. So we've already, our first example we had today was, it turns out somebody could like fake my request with cross-site scripting, right? So we have to do things because we can't trust where the data come from. So we started doing things in code now to help address the deficiency in that protocol. Shouldn't we be looking at, you know, I can't guarantee that the IMU is going to work properly but at least be able to trust that the communication is coming from where it's intended to and is going to where it's supposed to go to, and start building security into the technology, on the, not technology, but on the protocol, such that way it takes some of that stuff away from the developer having to worry about some of that stuff.
So in that particular example, I mean, the protocol is HTTP. If you modified the protocol, you would break the entire internet.
Right. I'm not talking about HTTP. But as we start talking about autonomous cars, like CAN bus, anybody can talk to anything, right? So the assumption is, if I get told to do something, I'm going to do it. As we start doing more and more devices and start coming up with new protocols, shouldn't there be a forethought to trusted communication, regardless if the data is bad, but the communication is trusted?
The thing about protocols is, I mean, you build your layers of trust, right?
Mm-hmm.
And it's going where you're coding at. You don't know always, you know, you never trust your input, and probably never, we talked about it in 101, don't run, you know, input as code. But that you also have to frame that. A protocol is a definition of saying I expect it to work this way. And you know, it's that balance of being able to making sure that you're, you know, giving those test cases of and sanitize your input to, like, I've got a protocol and I expect to see data along this way. I mean, what would you?
So I think the explicit answer to your question is, the question was, can we build security into those protocols? And the answer is, of course we can, right? Yes, we can build security into the protocol. The question then becomes, does adding security to the protocol cause more issues, right? And let's take it out of cars for a second. Let's put it into biometrics, right? With biometrics, you always have a crossover error rate, right? The CER. And you have to judge when you're rolling out biometrics if you would rather more people able to fool the system to get in and get in, or people who should be allowed in to be blocked from getting in. So the biometrics in Windows 10, more people can look into my computer and be me than just me, right? Because Windows 10 is designed for a consumer system, and for a consumer system, it wants to be a friendly and convenient, right? On the other side, if I'm trying to do an iris scan into the Mission Impossible data center, mm-hmm. right? We want, even if I just have blurry eyes because I was up late last night, and that's a horrible example.
Smoking the ganja, that's what it
is. Yeah, that works, right? Whatever. We don't want me in. That's acceptable. When you start talking about a car, now let's jump over to the car system. When you start talking about a car system, if you have any wiggle in that data and it breaks the security of that protocol, do you want it to fail open or fail closed? Right? If it's whether or not the car will stop because it doesn't know if it's because I pressed the brake or whether the autonomous system made the choice, I'd rather the car stop. Because while there is a good chance that if I stop when I'm not supposed to, I may get hit from the rear, there is an absolute definite chance that if I don't stop when I'm supposed to, I'm going to cause more problems, right? And so we have to make that decision. And I don't know where that right decision is. And that's why I say the answer is yes, we can build the security. The question is, do we want to?
I think the answer is yes, because if you don't have at least some level of trust, then you're relying on the developer to make sure they trust nothing.
But now you're relying.
We've proven that doesn't work.
But now you're relying on the fact that the protocol will always be trustworthy. No, it's not.
No,
TCP/IP is not trustworthy. Does it? Really?
With a really, really lame checksum, though. It's not cryptographically secured by any means.
Not a full hash or anything.
It's not trustworthy. CRC says the data I think I'm supposed to get is there. There is no cryptographic protection on TCP.
I'm off mic, but it does attempt to validate that the byte sent.
It sends an acknowledgement.
Yes, but what you're saying is you're using two different terms.
I want to follow up, by the way. Validation versus integrity is what he's saying.
Right.
But the thing is, I understand if somebody's going to find that strange, nuanced way to hack my system, I want to protect against all the script kiddies out there that can just throw something out of the network and say, have a nice day.
So what you're saying is, I feel like what you're saying is that you want to build a protocol that's unhackable so autonomous cars work, right? And what I'm saying is, we absolutely can build a protocol that is secure. But does the security of the system, and I don't know the answer, I don't know the right answer, but my concern would be that the security on the system in and of itself causes an availability problem. And if I have an availability problem while I'm doing 90 miles an hour down I-10, that's not good, right? And I'm way less concerned about a script kiddie deciding to screw up every autonomous car out there than I am about the person in front of me cutting me off.
And there is not going to be a protocol that they're going to make that's going to be, quote, in the long run, unhackable.
Yeah,
as soon as somebody calls a protocol unhackable, guess what? There's probably 90,000 hackers out there trying to hack it.
Yeah, ask Oracle about David Litchfield.
That's free pen testing. Just call yourself unhackable.
Well, that's not called pen testing, just to be clear. That is called hacking.
I mean, there are companies that pay people to hack their stuff just to see if they can do it. So I guess it's like penetration testing to a certain extent, but...
Wasn't it John McAfee put out his unhackable wallet and put up a $1 million reward? It is unhackable. And immediately that offer came off the plate.
What do you pay him in, though?
Does everybody want to break for pizza now, or do you want to ask a couple more questions?
Pizza.
Pizza?
Pizza.
Then what are you doing still sitting down? Get up and get some pizza.
I'm okay with that. I would not vote for that.